if these groups settle with the federal government, if we're not a party, we won't be at the table, even though it's our land and our citizens' jobs at stake.
The state steps into the lawsuit over Tongass logging. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 1st of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the highs and lows for Alaska's programs in the president's budget proposal.
I'm disappointed that a $10 million reduction in the health facilities construction program, which has been very, very beneficial to Alaska and rural communities.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist awards. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
President Obama's proposed $3.8 trillion budget for the next fiscal year was unveiled today in Washington. It includes hits for Alaska's programs, but some benefits as well. APRN's Libby Casey has more.
The White House proposes slashing all $10 million of the Denali Commission's healthcare facilities construction program. It says it's one of a handful of local health projects that aren't subject to a competitive process, and that there are other sources of merit-based federal funding that can accomplish the same goals. However, Senator Mark Begich says at least the commission's base funding of nearly $12 million remains intact.
You know, I'm disappointed that a $10 million reduction in the health facilities construction program, which has been very, very beneficial to Alaska and rural communities. But on the positive side, he has maintained the base level that he had last year, which means he hasn't reduced it any further, which is a good sign. As we said last year, we had a couple years of stabilization we have to do before we can continue to move forward and growing the Denali Commission again.
President Obama also wants to eliminate the High Energy Cost Grants Program, which sends money to utilities in rural areas where rates are especially high. Senator Lisa Murkowski's office says Alaska has gotten a sizable chunk of it in recent years, $10 to $12 million of a national total of $18 million. But the White House says the bulk of the money directly supports fossil fuels, and so is on the chopping block as part of the president's commitment to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. Murkowski's spokesman on the Energy Committee, Robert Dillon, says they'll argue a case that Alaska's rural utilities need the money.
The administration zeroed out the funding last year. Senator Murkowski was able to get it put back in, and she will try again this year to put that money, restore that money for Alaska, because it's real important to the communities.
The president's budget would cut $13 million from the Alaska Land Conveyance Program, but the delegation plans to fight that, too. Senator Begich says right after the budget came out, he got a call from the Bureau of Land Management's director, anticipating he would be concerned. Begich says the money is necessary to survey lands so the federal government can meet its legal responsibility to Alaska Native corporations, the state, and individual Alaska Natives.
They're going to now be several years delayed. And they'll argue, no, 96% of them are, you know, being transferred. That's correct. But you can't do the full transfer of ownership until the surveys are done. There's over 40% that haven't been surveyed. And without the survey, the land's useless. So, and they recognize this is going to be important for me, and we got to figure it out.
The oil and gas industry and Alaska's delegation are concerned about the president's plan to end billions of dollars in tax incentives to oil and gas companies. But Interior Secretary Ken Salazar defends the decision.
All you have to do is to look at the record profits of the oil and gas world over the last several years. And in my view, you're going to continue to see a great interest in oil and gas because it's an essential part of our economy today. It's expected that it will be, and I know it will be in the years ahead. And so I think the oil and gas industry will do just fine.
The White House says Alaska will likely benefit from the proposed budget in education funding, small business loan guarantees, and more than $700 million for construction projects. It raises military pay and expands medical care to service members and their families. Senator Begich says he's pleased with military spending. His office estimates the budget calls for about $420 million in construction at Alaska's installations and boosts funding for ground-based missile defense. The budget is thousands thousands of pages long, and the delegation, staffs, the Alaska Governor's Office, and others are poring over it to decipher what exactly it could mean for the state. It's just a proposal. Next, Congress will have its say. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Governor Sean Parnell is going to court to support logging in the Tongass National Forest. He told his top lawyer to try to intervene in two environmental lawsuits seeking to reduce timber cutting. One would remove the forest's exemption from a nationwide ban on logging in roadless areas. The other seeks to block the logjam timber sale on Prince of Wales Island, also known as the diesel sale. Attorney General Dan Sullivan says the state has a direct interest in the lawsuits.
We think the federal government's decision will help create economic opportunity. And these groups are trying to reverse the federal government decision and essentially shut down the economic opportunity in terms of allowing timber harvest. And we think that that fits squarely within the state's interest to be involved in the lawsuits.
Greenpeace, the Tongass Conservation Society, and Cascadia Wildlands sued last month to block the logjam sale. They say the action was needed to protect wildlife, especially the Alexander Archipelago wolf. These groups were among about a dozen filing suit in December to overturn the roadless rule exemption. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the organized village of Cake, and others say the suit would protect old-growth forests used for hunting, fishing, subsistence, and tourism. The suits are against the federal government, not the state. Sullivan says that's why the Parnell administration wants to get involved.
If these groups settle with the federal government, if we're not a party, we won't be at the table, even though it's our land and our citizens' jobs at stake. Secondly, if there's a element of the lawsuit or the court decision that doesn't come out the way we think is in the state's interest, if you're a party, you have the opportunity to appeal.
Klawak-based Viking Lumber won the right to log the diesel timber sale, part of the logjam sale area, in December. Other sales would be affected by lifting the roadless rule exemption. The State House today corrected an incomplete law originally passed 4 years ago, and the change makes living in rural Alaska a little bit safer. Anchorage Democrat Lindsay Holmes told members that although sexual assault restraining orders were put into statute in 2006, there was an oversight in the legislation.
The legislature forgot to give permission to magistrates and district court judges to actually issue the restraining orders. It has now come to everyone's attention, and we are starting to see cases across the state in which magistrates and district court judges are not issuing these orders, and it's leaving some people, particularly in rural areas, without access to them.
The bill passed with no opposition and next goes to the Senate, where it's expected to get quick action. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, modesty in the face of national recognition.
And I'm completely humbled by it. I know a lot of people in the system who are working awful hard and doing a lot of stuff. I really don't feel worthy, I gotta admit.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The Pebble Partnership has released new data showing a larger mineral resource at the Pebble deposit near Iliamna Lake in southwest Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The new update to the mineral resource estimate is based on the results of the partnership's drilling program in 2008 and 2009. Mike Heatwall is a spokesman for the Pebble Partnership.
Shows in general an increase over our last estimate, which we had shared in the latter part of 2008. Increases in all mineral categories, the copper, gold, and molybdenum.
The new estimate is based on 509 drill holes, including 37 new holes that have been drilled since the middle of 2008. The estimate for the amount of measured and indicated copper in the deposit is 55 billion pounds, which is up 12% compared to the estimate released in December of 2008. The estimate for the amount of measured and indicated gold in the deposit is 67 million ounces, which is up 14% compared to the earlier estimate. The estimate for the amount of measured and indicated molybdenum is 3.3 billion pounds, which is up 16% compared to the previous estimate. Those estimates do not include the inferred mineral resource, which stands at well over 25 billion pounds of copper, over 40 million ounces of gold, and over 2.3 billion pounds of molybdenum. Heatwall says the drilling program over the past couple of years confirms more minerals in the deposit.
The more holes that you drill, the greater predicted certainty that you get. Of course, nothing would be fully certain until you start mining, but as you you drill more holes, your knowledge of what's there is enhanced, and that's what's happened here. And then there's also an economic calculation that factors into the estimate.
Heatwall confirms that the Pebble Partnership is currently examining the details of its proposed scope of work for this year, and that plan will be announced once it's approved by the partnership's board of directors.
We're looking at all of our data and planning our summer exploration program, so our site work will start to pick up as we get closer to May. Our season looks like probably May to October in terms of the higher activity. But we'll probably have a better sense on our work plan with more details here probably the next several weeks.
One of the major goals for the Pebble Partnership this year, according to Heatwall, is to conclude the pre-feasibility study for the proposed Pebble Mine.
In terms of 2010, we're not currently planning on going into permitting. And from a stakeholder news perspective, the best thing to be on the lookout for is conclusion of what we call our pre-feasibility study work, which again is the engineering, environmental, and economic work to determine what type of project we would ultimately take forward. And then really the product to look for out of that is what we call a preliminary development plan, which addresses a lot of the questions that folks have about Pebble. And then from that, there's kind of two key documents that you take into permitting. There's the preliminary development plan, which sketches out, the mine, transportation corridor, port, and all of that. And then the environmental baseline document, which is the baseline characterization of the environment in and around what we call the mine study area. And those two are essentially what you take into permitting and present to the government agencies, and then they begin their extensive review.
The news release announcing the new resource estimate at the Pebble Deposit notes that the likelihood of future mining at the Pebble Deposit is subject to a large number of risks and will require achievement of a number of technical, economic, and legal objectives, including obtaining the necessary mining and construction permits and completion of the pre-feasibility and final feasibility studies. Heatwall says the project still faces some challenges.
And while there's definitely a resource there, turning that into a development plan is a significant piece of work, and that's what we're focused on.
You can find the new resource estimate for the Pebble Deposit on the Pebble Partnership website at pebblepartnership.com. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Lawmakers and residents alike celebrated the completion of the Swan Tie Electrical Intertie Friday night at Ketchikan's Ted Ferry Civic Center. The Flip the Switch event was the culmination of the project, more than 30 years and $100 million in the making. Deanna Garrison of KRBD has the story.
The 57-mile transmission line connects Ketchikan's hydroelectric facility at Swan Lake with Petersburg and Wrangell's main power source at Tie Lake. Southeast Alaska Power Agency CEO Dave Carlson says the intertie has been up and running since mid-December.
I'm here to tell you we got the project done, and even more importantly, it's working.
Since the project came online, Carlson says Tie has provided Ketchikan with 5.75 million kilowatt hours worth of electricity.
If you wanted to equate that into the gallons of diesel, if you had to generate that power with diesel, it's about 381,000 gallons. So it's like $1 million worth of diesel. So it is working for the benefit of the ratepayers in Ketchikan and for the benefit of the ratepayers in Wrangell and Petersburg too.
The project is owned and operated by the Southeast Alaska Power Agency. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski told the crowd that there were times when she wasn't so sure that the project was going to be completed.
When all the federal funds had been spent on the engineering and the design and then the preparation, and when the Forest Service was complicating the project, and when the inflation was driving up the cost of the steel and the power cable, I really did worry that this power line corridor could become the longest 57-mile white elephant in Alaskan history.
Murkowski says the intertie will do more than provide energy-strapped Ketchikan with access to excess hydropower from Tai'i.
We've got a transmission line now. It's going to benefit the environment in terms of reduction in emissions. It's going to save money from the cost of the diesel. But it's got even more. It's kind of like the Ginsu knife. There's more to this, because what it does, it allows us to kind of open up other segments of the Southeast Intertie. We can link the northern panhandle to the southern tip of Alaska, hopefully on to British Columbia and points south.
Murkowski says she will work to develop the other approximately 36 hydroelectric projects currently in the planning stages around Southeast. With those hydro projects and the addition of wind, geothermal, and tidal energy, Murkowski says the region could become a major supplier of renewable energy to the Pacific coast. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman says Swan Tai'i was the first step in a larger effort to create a Southeast Alaska power grid.
It wasn't the Swan Tai'i connection that was really the goal. The goal is the Southeast Intertie, and if the Swan Tai'i connection failed, the rest of the intertie is going to drop like a domino, and it'll take generations to bring it back.
If and when a Southeast Intertie is completed, Stedman says he would ultimately like to explore the prospect of connecting to Anchorage so the region could provide excess power to the rail belt. Jean Terrio, energy advisor for Governor Parnell, says the state government is committed to developing projects like Swan Tai'i that will provide affordable energy to residents.
I don't know that we'll ever see the cheap energy again, but we want to ultimately be affordable energy and, almost as important, predictable.
Terrio says the many Alaskan communities relying on diesel power can't bank on low or stable rates, since diesel prices fluctuate greatly. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A state commission study identifies a 500-mile road from Manly Hot Springs along the Yukon River and onto Nome as the best option for opening up a ground transportation corridor to western Alaska. Department of Transportation spokesman Roger Weatherall says the proposed route offers some obvious benefits.
The shortest distance between Fairbanks and Nome, and so that there in itself would help for transporting goods, services between those communities. And, you know, there's always that terrific possibility of creating more jobs for Alaskans by having such a road project take place.
The study estimates the cost of building the 30-foot-wide gravel road at $2.3 to $2.7 billion, with another nearly $40 million annually for maintenance. That's weighed against $19 million in yearly savings on shipping costs for five communities along the way, and $120 million in annual import and export services savings for existing mines. Weatherall says the road could also open up new resource development.
With the potential for gas exploration, mineral exploration along the route, you could possibly see intake of incredible amounts of revenue dollars for the state.
The $1 million study prepared by the national engineering firm Dowell HKM also considers socioeconomic and subsistence impacts. Weatherall says Governor Parnell has yet to be fully briefed on the road report, but has already proposed a $1 million for additional study of the road in his budget for next year.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Alaska Gasline Port Authority will be able to sell federally backed bonds to help finance a North Slope gas project. The Borough Assembly voted last week to give the public group $28 million in bonding authority granted the borough under the Federal Economic Stimulus Bill. Measure sponsor, Assemblyman Tim Beck, says access to the bonds will help finance a local aspect of the authority's plan to truck North Slope gas to Fairbanks.
The bonds must be spent and utilized within the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and so that would mean infrastructure. And the intent behind this particular proposal would that they'd utilize the funds to build that which is necessary in the North Pole community to store the LNG.
The large gas storage facility would supply Golden Valley Electric with a lower-cost, cleaner-burning fuel for the North Pole power plant. GVEA will be an anchor tenant for the North Slope Gas and is one of several moving parts in the project. The Port Authority is in the process of purchasing local private utility Fairbanks Natural Gas, which would truck the gas to town and distribute it locally. The project also requires a more than $100 million gas processing facility on the North Slope. Port Authority Board Member Merrick Pierce spoke in support of the bond measure. Pierce said the project is aimed at providing cheaper, cleaner energy to Fairbanks. Pierce told the Assembly the government-backed bonds will lower the cost of the project.
This will subsidize some of the interest we will pay on some of the debt that we're going to incur as part of our acquisition of Fairbanks Natural Gas and building the associated infrastructure. And it's a fairly significant reduction in the rate of interest that we'd pay. So real clear benefits. Lower gas prices mean that the gas distribution system will be expanded fairly quickly. People are going to clearly see the advantage of going to gas over oil.
The Assembly unanimously voted to allow the Port Authority to sell the government-granted bonds. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act issued the bonding authority to communities that have suffered military downsizing, like the loss of F-16 fighters at Eielson Air Force Base. Alaskans are well represented among those selected by the National Wildlife Refuge Association and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to receive 2010 Refuge System Awards. They include a group of dedicated volunteers that make up the Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuges and a supervisory wildlife biologist at the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. KBBI's Marsha Lynn has more.
Vernon Bird of Homer has spent his entire career with the refuge system. He's worked at five different locations in Alaska and Hawaii, which may seem like a contrast, but not so, says Bird.
There's a lot more in common than, you know, might meet the eye, at least in terms of wildlife resources, because some of the same issues occur in both areas because they're sort of marine ecosystems.
Bird has a modest reaction to being named Refuge System Employee of the Year.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected, and I'm completely humbled by it. I know a lot of people in the system who are working awful hard and doing a lot of stuff, and I really don't feel worthy, I got to admit.
One main focus of his work is invasive species and finding ways to restore native biodiversity on islands in the refuge by reducing predatory animals such as Arctic foxes and Norway rats. He says there's been a good response by the native bird population.
The whole system seemed to have the resiliency to bounce back once those introduced mammals are removed. Well, I guess we don't know whether there's complete restoration to pristine conditions because it may take longer than we've been watching. But it appears to be, for the most part, restored. In some cases, we have to actually move some species that don't pioneer very readily on their own. And that's what we did with the Aleutian cackling goose, and we've done it more recently with a rare subspecies of rock ptarmigan in the Aleutians.
Bird, a longtime advocate for marine conservation, is clearly in his element working for the refuge system.
You know, most of it I can't believe I get paid to do. And it's not just me, but our whole team. And I think a lot of us feel that way. It's just so interesting to us, and it's, you know, it's been more of a way of life than a job, I guess. It's an unusual organization in that folks really feel like they're doing something that they like to do and they think is worthwhile.
Friends of the Alaska Wildlife Refuges received the Friends Group of the Year award. Founded in 2005, the group has taken on the huge job of supporting and raising awareness of the more than 75 million acres of land that comprise Alaska's wildlife refuges. Bird says the Friends Groups offer help nationwide.
They do a whole range of things for refuges all over the country, often associated with visitor services and some refuges, frequently with projects that require focused effort for relatively short periods, like a place where there's invasive plants and they're just getting started and volunteers go out there and pull them all up.
Which is just what volunteers from the Alaska Friends Group have been doing.
Actually pulling invasive weeds along the Dalton Highway for years, pulling white sweet clover, and that's on our hands and knees in the dust, and we actually pull them. Whatever the refuges need us to do, we try and accomplish.
That's Sharon Bauer, founding member and current vice president of the Alaska Friends Group. She lives in Homer and spends her winters in Arizona. Bauer says it's quite a task to coordinate projects for the state's 16 wildlife refuges, where only two are road accessible.
You can't just walk to your refuge. I'm here in the state of Arizona, and every one of our refuges you can drive to here. And you want to make people understand that that's their refuge and what it's all about and to take ownership of it.
Bauer says in addition to tackling problems like invasive plants, they do a lot of public outreach, like helping with last year's 100th anniversary celebration of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. She says outreach work continues this year as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the Eisenbach National Wildlife Refuge each celebrates its 50th anniversary. The 2010 Refuge System Awards reception will be held in Washington, D.C. on March 9th. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries took a step toward rebuilding the King Salmon Run on the Yukon River. The board voted yesterday to prohibit subsistence and commercial fishing from using gill nets with a mesh larger than 7.5 inches starting in 2011. The goal of the regulation is to allow more of the larger king salmon to spawn. State fish managers have not allowed any commercial fishing the past 2 years, and subsistence fishing was cut in half this past season. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Marsha Lynn in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846, press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.